As we enter into the year 2021, we want to be really intentional about covering the topics that are most important for OTs to be thinking about. And right off the bat, we wanted to dive into how our global pandemic has upended OT education. Now, I knew to tackle this topic that I wanted to hear from my friends Lauren and Melissa, who both work in academia. But what I wasn't expecting was how personal and how relevant this conversation would feel to me. I am about as far removed from higher education as you can get, but this episode really made me reflect on how I personally aspire to manage challenges like the pandemic and how our profession at large can be a leader in navigating tough times with grace. If you are interested in earning a continuing education certificate for this episode, I'll hop back in at the end of the conversation and tell you how to do so. But without further ado, I will turn you over to Lauren and Melissa. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we dive deep into research and pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Lauren, and here with Melissa Kimmerling. Dr. Kimmerling is the founding program director for the Master of Occupational Therapy program at Nebraska Methodist College in Omaha, Nebraska. And we're looking forward to having a conversation today about OT education during a pandemic, what has changed, and what we'll take with us post-COVID. So welcome to the podcast, Melissa. So excited to have you.
Thanks, Lauren. Thanks for asking me to come on today.
Can you give the listeners just a little bit more background about yourself and particularly your journey into education?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I am a program director and I'm actually the founding program director. So I was involved in all aspects of getting a program up and off the ground at the master's level here in Omaha. And prior to that, I did work full-time for 3 years for another academic institution. And then clinically, I've worked in many different areas, as many therapists do. But I would say my largest emphasis of practice has been in acute care. I'm also really involved in policy in my state organization. I have a volunteer position as the vice president of policy and advocacy for the Nebraska Occupational Therapy Association. So a lot of what I'll be talking about today probably has a little bit of a policy and higher education lens to it because of that role that I have as well.
Excellent. Well, we're excited to have a rich discussion. Of course, lots in our lives have changed over this last year, and education has changed as the world has changed. We'll be talking about how trends in higher education have been impacted by COVID, what COVID brought to us that surprised us related to higher education, and we'll also be exploring what is likely to change about OT education as we move forward past the pandemic. Just to give listeners a little context and kind of catch us up, particularly those of us that are not in higher education full time, will you give us some background as to trends that we were seeing in higher education before the pandemic?
Sure. So there's a lot of things that the higher education world has been keeping an eye on overall for a long time, even prior to myself being in a leadership position within higher education. And the things that I think are most impactful to talk about are enrollment and retention and student success. So prior to COVID and now, of course, we know that students' socioeconomic status impacts educational access and then educational performance. And we know that certain populations have more barriers to accessing higher education, such as students from low-income backgrounds that maybe face a barrier in the cost of college applications, for example. And this is really well documented in research. It doesn't take much to get online and find a lot of information that supports the connection between a student's background and their likelihood for success in higher education. And the Global Monitoring Report from UNESCO, actually published in 2020, calls on all education actors to widen their understanding of inclusive education to ensure that it includes all learners, no matter their background, their identity, and to really think about diversity in the core of education systems. So this is something that has been on the minds of decision makers in higher education for a long time. How can we recruit and retain students that really represent our population as a whole and not just certain facets of the population that have less barriers to accessing higher education. And, you know, this has led to some poor diversity in some healthcare fields, including occupational therapy. And it's actually a big enough of a problem that Congress is attempting to open up funding for colleges to recruit and retain students from more diverse backgrounds, specifically for occupational therapy, speech language pathology, physical therapy, and audiology. And that's HR 3637. And it was introduced in July of 2019. So it's a big enough problem that there's enough literature to support that the federal government needs to do something to ensure that we have a healthcare system and healthcare practitioners that represent the populations in which they serve. So I think that's a trend that we were really seeing. And what ties right into that is this increasing need for students to have devices. You know, when you and I went to school, Lauren, it may have been nice to have a computer, but not essential. You could access one in the library if you needed to, and it wasn't an essential part of what you were doing every day. But now that device really is essential for our student success, and it may or may not be provided by an institution. So you've got a lot of conversations about what the role is of the educational institution in providing that device or not, since it has moved from being nice to being necessary. And going right along with that too is then the competency, that digital literacy, we call it, you know, being able to function both in the online environment and the face-to-face environment, because even your face-to-face classes nowadays have an online component. You know, the syllabus is posted online, mm-hmm. your assignments are submitted online, nobody prints a paper and hands it in anymore. That just doesn't happen. So we've gone from, you know, nice to have to need to have, and colleges are really grappling with, how do we ensure all of our learners have these things if they are necessary without building computer labs with 700 computers? Because that's not really a doable thing either. And then student engagement is a big part of what we've been talking about too. So we've got a lot of data that indicates that the engaged student, the one that comes and participates and does the things that are optional and not just the things that are necessary, is the student that really gets the most out of the educational experience. And technology provides us a lot of opportunity to increase student engagement, but it's not easy for all instructors to implement, and it's not easy for all students to engage with. So we have to ensure that our faculty and our students have those digital literacy skills to really get the most out of what technology can offer us today too. And then the last thing that I really thought about in response to this question was the student mental health crisis. So even in K through 12 education, you'll see an increased emphasis on social emotional learning. I know my son's on remote learning, so I have the ability to sit in on fourth grade again, and every day they start with social emotional learning, and it's a wonderful thing, but that didn't come out of nowhere. That came out of a crisis in our students' mental health, and we're seeing that in higher education as well. Higher education is demanding and expensive and challenging, and sometimes challenging for the first time for individuals. You know, a lot of students that I work with never had negative feedback or constructive criticism before, and it can be hard to start getting it. So we've really been talking about the role of the faculty and the role of the college in supporting students and the impact of addressing our students' mental health needs on retention, which, you know, recruitment is the first thing and then retention is the next in order for our organizations to be successful. So those are some big trends that have been occurring in higher education. I could talk forever about funding, but I think that's a whole other podcast.
That's a great summary, and thanks for walking us through that. Tell us a little bit about, now that we're, you know, in the last stretch of 2020 here and through 2020, COVID has really impacted a lot of sectors, a lot of areas of our lives, and education has most definitely been affected. You mentioned your son on remote learning. You know, our college and university systems have had to transform the way that they bring learning to students. How has COVID accelerated the trends that you mentioned in your experience as a program director? Or what has been reframed or maybe dropped from the conversation? What has risen to the top as maybe more important during this time? And which of those trends has really come through as impacted most by COVID?
The thing that I think has impacted the most has been that concern for students' mental health during these times. The pandemic has just added additional stresses, additional responsibilities to our student populations, remembering, especially at the OTR level, you know, these are adults. These are often parents and siblings and people who are now potentially also ensuring the success of their own children and their own remote learning. So the stresses and the challenges, and I think the lack of predictability has really been what my students have said to me is the hardest. The fact that I couldn't tell them what November was going to be like, or I couldn't tell them for sure if we were going to have a field trip. I couldn't tell them for sure if our guest speaker was going to come. It was very much a week at a time this fall in relationship to planning. And that is really hard for a student who is trying to balance so many things. So it's difficult normally, and the pandemic has just really added to that. And we've seen that increased need for our student support services on campus, for really well-trained advisors, for 24-hour mental health support. You know, we've opened a 24-hour student assistance program that they're able to call all the time. We've doubled our face-to-face counselors for support. We have really increased the amount of support we give for students' mental health needs in the span of two semesters. So I know that that is first and foremost the most important thing, because if we can't address those needs, all of the rest of it is just a moot point, right? We're just not going to have a student that's successful if we don't meet their mental health needs. So that I think is the thing that's really risen to the top if you talk about importance. And then some other things that we've really seen impacted is, you know, as I mentioned, students from certain backgrounds already face more barriers to pursuing higher education, and now they have even more barriers. You know, these same demographics, you know, students from non-English speaking households or first generation college students already, or low income students, already have barriers to college. And now they potentially are frontline workers or shift workers or essential workers, or they live in multi-generational households or shared housing situations that put them at higher risk for COVID-19. And they may have work schedules that are changing left and right, and we're expecting them to be able to commit to a certain class schedule when working for them is essential and not just an option. We've just seen so many additional barriers added disproportionately to some populations. And I think it's really led to the decrease that we have seen in enrollment, how it has disproportionately affected certain groups. And, you know, one of the resources I provided for you, Lauren, that I think will be linked for anyone who's listening to this is from the Chronicle of Higher Education, where they were looking at National Student Clearinghouse data that reported 21.7% overall fewer students went to college right out of high school than in 2019. And if you look at this reference, it even further breaks down that 21% into low income, high poverty, high school, non-English speaking, all of that. And you can see how there are just certain groups that were just disproportionately affected. And to put that in context, we already knew enrollment was going down. This is not new, but the drop between 2018 and 2019 was 2.8%. And then the drop between 2019 and 2020 was 21.7%. So yeah, if you keep in mind that higher education is a business, right? Our product is the education that we provide and the courses that we offer. You know, that's not a sustainable business model if we continue to decrease our enrollment by 20% every year. So huge, huge disproportionate impacts on certain parts of our population as well. And then I personally saw in my experience the need for student devices and that discussion that had always been kind of like, you know, what's our 5-year plan? What are we going to do? How are we going to, you know, get devices in students' hands? Which devices are they going to use? We were originally on a plan where we had determined it was going to be iPads because we have Apple TVs. There's a lot of flexibility. in what the Apple technology can do. And the original plan was to really slowly roll them out, get them in faculty's hands first, ensure the faculty can even use them, because it would be very frustrating as a student to pay for a device or to, you know, get a device that you didn't see people use. And then, you know, really embrace them and then get them out kind of slowly. And it turned into everybody's getting iPads and we're all getting them at the same time and you're expected to use them and be competent with them today. Because they wanted to ensure that if we shut down again, we could still keep going. We wouldn't lose those weeks. We could still keep going. So I found that acceleration on my own campus, and I anticipate a lot of my peers saw some accelerated timelines in relationship to getting devices in students' hands as well. And that accelerated faculty training and faculty competency. And in a very crazy pandemic world where we were, you know, trying to move things to an online environment, we were also trying to figure out how to really be our best in this online environment too. Now, the program that I'm the program director for is hybrid. So we're normally online for our lectures and face-to-face for our labs, but we had to move even labs online. And even as an instructor who spends a good amount of time in the online environment, that's a challenge. To move a lab online is quite a challenge, even as someone who's pretty comfortable in the online environment. So I anticipate a lot of my peers felt that way too. So those are really some of the things that I feel like really were accelerated. And, you know, the last thing I'll talk about is what I mentioned related to student engagement. We really have seen in the last couple semesters that we have got to find ways to build relationships with our students and, as a program director, with my team, you know, with my peers. It's different when you're not all face-to-face and you can't just poke your head into someone's office and run something by them, or a student can't just drop by. We ensure that we were available to them, but the perception is still that, you know, maybe they're not, right? Like, Dr. Kimmerling gave me her phone number, but does she really okay with me calling, right? So we really had to be proactive about having those opportunities to get your face in front of people and to just have conversations that weren't even connected to a specific assignment or a specific course. And that is the thing I think that we're continuing to try to figure out what the best way to do that is, because you can really build amazing things that you think are great for student engagement and not have great participation and then have to start again. So I'll be interested to see over this next 6 months to a year, kind of where we land on ensuring student engagement in the either online or hybrid or high flex, some people are calling it, environments.
Yeah. As we look at the bright spots, of course, I think as OTs, part of our, you know, training, part of who we are is looking at the potential for learning as well as looking at the bright spots in challenging times. What positive aspects have you found that COVID has brought to the academic environment? And what are we learning from the experience that might and is transforming the way that education will happen in the future?
Yeah, I think it's so hard in such a dark time to be thinking about gratitude for a pandemic, but there are pieces of it that I don't think we ever would have gotten to so quickly without this forced situation. And, you know, some of that relates to flexibility in teaching models. So something we were forced to do was to think differently about things we've done for a long time. And there were a lot of assignments or activities or learning opportunities that occurred differently for the first time in years because the instructor really liked what they were doing. They really felt strongly about what they were doing and they were forced to try something different. And many of them discovered, myself included, that alternate suggestion or that opportunity that we would have never pursued if it hadn't been for COVID was an even better experience for the student. So I think it has opened up people's willingness to try something different or to rethink the flexibility that's built within existing courses. So, for example, pre-COVID, you've got your syllabus, your deadlines are your deadlines, your assignments are your assignments, and there you go. And I have found more faculty and more members of my team and more colleagues that I have from other institutions really thinking differently about even the concept of a deadline. You know, why did we pick Sunday at 11:55 p.m.? Is that just to give them a deadline or is that really necessary? And what if we gave this adult learner more flexibility in when and how they completed those expectations? Or what if we gave them choice in how they demonstrated a learning objective? For example, our students who are also with children on remote learning have a harder time doing video participation where they're expected to speak because their background is quite noisy, or they're concerned with disrupting their own children. But do they really have to speak? Could they contribute through the chat box? Could they, you know, do a different assignment altogether that didn't involve that voice or that recording component? So before, I just don't think we were flexible. It wasn't my experience at either institution that I've been at that people were very flexible in what that final project would look like, for example. And I think we're thinking about, well, maybe they could do a presentation or write a paper. And how could we create multiple learning opportunities in which we could ensure that those learning objectives and ultimately those accreditation standards are met? So the pandemic forced us to do that. And I think it wasn't as scary as a lot of people thought that it was. And we're going to see that. And we're going to see the students demand it, I think, too. Now they know that we can be flexible and that we can and will listen to their feedback. And I think moving forward, they're going to hold us to that. They're going to say, hey, listen, in the fall, you gave us so much grace, and I still need that grace. So can I continue to have that? So I think we're going to see students demanding the kind of, I don't know what else to call it other than the grace that we've given them this fall moving forward. So at least the students who were in college during the COVID-19 pandemic, maybe someday that won't be the case, but I think it will be for this group of students. And I think we were surprised too at how resilient students can be. We're so concerned for their mental health. We are worried about putting too much stress on them or really finding that optimal level of anxiety, right? It's good to be a little nervous than to have high standards, but you want to walk that line between pushing them over the edge with something that's completely unfamiliar and something that they're not used to. But we have found that students have been really resilient, and that as long as you're transparent and communicate well, that they'll roll with the punches. They trust you. They came to you and they came to your program or your institution because they believe in you and they believe in your mission and your institution. And they do. They trust you and they will go with you, and they are resilient and they are capable. And I know that our 2020 graduates, they're so funny to talk to because they sort of feel like, I'll take a travel job. Sure. You know, I'll do it. I can do anything. You know, they just feel like because of what they experienced for field work, you know, being halfway through their first level two, experiencing field work and getting just so many things thrown at them that we obviously didn't teach in an academic program. It wasn't a thing, right? They just got thrown into situations that they may or may not have been prepared for, but you know what? They were successful, and their confidence and their belief in themselves, I think, is just so much different than I've seen with prior graduates. So I think that they can do more than we think they can. They're more resilient than we often think that they are. And if we communicate and we're transparent, they're really open to trying new things as well. But something that I think has come to the surface that may be a negative, but also long-term might be a positive, is this increased need to address faculty well-being too. Right? We get really focused on the students and what they need. They're our consumer, right? They're the person purchasing the product from our business. And we want them to have great experiences and to be well and to be great practitioners, but at what expense to us, right? So you're seeing faculty who are trying to be more flexible to their students and accommodating and do all these makeup sessions for students who were quarantining or who were in isolation because they were positive. And it really changed the way we look at workload and how busy people are and how much people can handle. And there's a lot of opinion pieces and editorials out there from faculty members who are talking about, you know, that faculty life has really changed for forever. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to go back to a situation where I'm going to be able to mandate 6 face-to-face office hours, for example. We've seen that that's not really necessary. What's essential is that we're there for our students. But when are you there? And what deadlines, you know, what boundaries do you have for your own occupational balance as well? So we're seeing more work from home and flexible policies to support families. And I think just like the students knowing what's possible, now faculty know that they're completely capable of doing their job from their home environment, and they're going to want that flexibility moving forward as well. And then how do we help faculty demarcate or find that balance between where work ends and home begins and really feel confident enough to tell their students, this is when I'm available to you and this is when I'm not, because I'm also a mom and a wife and a friend and a daughter, and those roles are important to me as well. So where do you draw that line while also still meeting their needs, since you're not at your desk for 6 hours a week where they can just drop in? So that, you know, again, maybe some negative impacts on faculty's mental health trying to get through the pandemic, but long-term, I think we're going to see some really positive things change in our society overall. You know, you may be in the same position, Lauren, where you've learned that, you know, I can do my job from multiple places and I can be effective with the right technology and the right support. So I think we're going to see the daily life of faculty kind of change long-term as well.
Definitely. You had mentioned in a previous conversation something that I just think is really interesting to highlight, a way that your lab experience for students changed and potentially for the better. You know, being able to try out some new models and new ways of engaging students that seemed to be a win. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, we have a couple things that we created out of necessity or urgency during the pandemic that were incredibly well received, that we're looking at becoming a longer term component of the curriculum. And the first is what we called boot camps. So like many institutions, mine went online in March, I think around March 15th, right, when this all happened in 2020, which was halfway through the spring semester. And in the spring, our students had three different classes that had a hands-on psychomotor lab that would have been held face-to-face. And we were able to do that. You know, we were able to deliver those in the online environment, but we always had that, you know, kind of voice in the back of our head wondering if that was going to be enough, wondering if they were going to be able to bring those psychomotor skills that they learned in an online environment into the fall, where they're again building off of these skills, having more complex versions of these skills, and then taking them into field work as well. So, like I said, my program's hybrid. We didn't change anything about our lectures, but we did see quite a bit impacted on our labs. So what we did was, as soon as we were allowed to be back on campus in August, we held a couple boot camps. And so we had these kind of longer chunks of time where a couple different instructors who had both taught things like transfers or hemiparetic dressing or weight bearing for the upper extremity or Brunstrom or Rood or some of these legitimate handling techniques. We had these boot camps where a student could sign up, because we again had to ensure that we kept our ratios low because of the distancing required. And we didn't even have an agenda. We just said, we're going to be here and we are here for you. Come with your questions. Come and tell us what you want to try again and we'll do it. And we collaborated. We had those faculty be together because we really wanted to make sure that they could take those skills into this fall. We didn't want to, quote unquote, attach them to a specific course. We just said, hey, come and we're available. We're both clinical practitioners. We're both able to help you with all this. And almost everyone signed up. Almost everyone came. And being someone who runs a lab, I do teach a lab myself. These days were so different. It was so different for the students. They weren't worried about what's on the test or what's on the practical or what's on this assignment. They literally just had questions. And the thought that there wasn't any component of their performance that was being graded. They weren't worried about doing something wrong in front of me or in front of my colleague. They really just wanted to know that they really knew how to do it. And they went so well. And we got great feedback that said, wow, we would like to have a Friday every month where we just had a chance to just come in and practice. And we had thought about, well, I don't know if we can do every month. You know, we have to think about the logistics of some of this, but we did allow some of that to occur again in the fall. So even though we were meeting face-to-face for labs in the fall, we did open up those kind of open lab, come with your questions, put it all together kind of sessions. And interestingly, we didn't have as many students come, but we did have some. And it wasn't a lot of extra work for the instructor. They didn't prepare anything different. They were just there and available. So we're looking at integrating these kind of formally moving forward. You know, what's our structure going to be? Is it going to be twice a semester? Could we structure these in order to help the students combine skills from multiple classes? Because you're probably aware from your education background too, that sometimes we have this issue with students putting information in silos, like this is mental health information, and this is acute care information, and this is skilled nursing, when really your skilled nursing patient has mental health concerns and psychosocial needs, and your acute care patient, you know, there just aren't those lines in practice. So we're trying to decide into the spring how that might look and how we might structure that. But we never would have done that. We did that just out of what we felt like was a need, got great feedback, felt ourselves like it was a really valuable use of our time, got, again, that positive student feedback. And we're looking at how we integrate those moving forward and even maybe collecting some data to give us some information about whether they really do make an impact on student performance in any capacity. So that's something that we are really excited about that we wouldn't have done if it weren't for the pandemic.
That's great. That's great. I think it's definitely caused most of us to look at our lives a little bit more creatively. So it's exciting to hear the evolution that has happened in your program, and I'm sure many others as well. In terms of, you know, how we move forward and what higher education and OT education looks like into 2021, and hopefully before too much time goes by, the post-COVID environment, right? If we can say that at some point, what do we need to consider as you pull all the pieces of your learnings, of how you've engaged students and faculty in different ways? What do we need to tune into as a profession and as professionals as we get into 2021 related to OT education?
I think that, you know, with all accredited programs, we go through that incredibly complex and detailed accreditation process where we have all of the accreditation standards and we submit. Now it's three pieces of proof for how you're going to ensure that standard is met. And that's wonderful and essential, but also something to think about. Are we going to need to be more creative and submit maybe six things for each of those, saying, hey, here's the three classes. And in these three classes, they're going to have an assignment, but they're going to get to choose. And here's how I'm showing you that no matter what they choose, we're still going to meet that standard. So I wonder about that. I mean, I philosophically really think we need to be creative about what we allow students to do or produce, or, you know, how we deliver the education, but we also have to keep, what did we tell our accrediting body? What are we supposed to do? What are we accredited based? We're accredited based upon what information? So I wonder if at the larger level, you know, the U.S. Department of Education or, you know, some of these decision-making bodies, if they're going to build in any opportunities for flexibility or help make sure that we are not in any capacity compromising our accreditation by being there for the students and keeping their needs first and potentially thinking differently than we thought we were, you know, 5 years ago when we submitted our last report, for example. So I think those creative delivery models and those creative ways for students to show us that they've met the learning objectives is something that we're going to have to think about and think about as a larger profession too, because we are responsible for ensuring excellent practitioners, right? That we are producing excellent future occupational therapists and ones that are helpful and successful on their level two fieldworks, and that we can partner with enough sites to support our students going through level two fieldwork. And so how do we really just kind of manage that, you know, manage what they need now and what they need from us now with what our sites expect them to know and with what our accrediting body expects them to know and what our board examination expects them to know. So there's just so many things that influence what you decide to teach in the 15 weeks that you have to get through a piece of content. And things like the boot camps are maybe ways where we can build in some flexibility or some additional opportunities that are you know, just above and beyond what we have to do for our accreditation or what we've reported that we're doing for accreditation. Just can we build in anything like that? That is an opportunity, but not required, but helpful. Mm-hmm. And do we need to collect data? Are we going to collect data? You know, when does it move from being optional to being permanent? So I think we're going to have to think through a lot of those things. And then, you know, like I said, just flexibility in those systems that control what it is we do. It's so important to be in a profession that has licensure and regulation for the safety of our patients. And the accreditation process is so essential in ensuring that no matter where a student chooses to pursue their academic education, that they know that that program is of high quality and that they're going to get a kind of a different perspective depending upon the mission and the values of the institution that they choose, but they're going to have a baseline generalist education no matter where they go. But there may be some flexibility that needs to be considered by some of these systems that will help us meet our ever-changing student needs rather than only getting to make those changes every time you're up for accreditation again. You know, like I said, for faculty too, as a program director, my students aren't doing well if my faculty aren't doing well. So what long-term things are we going to include moving forward? Are we going to calculate workload differently? Are we going to calculate service requirements differently? Are we going to allocate time for developing skills in that digital environment? Are we going to pay for people to get more education and competency in that digital environment? So I think that we always have to remember, in order for our students and our program outcomes to be well, the people delivering our education need to be well too. And that includes our full-time and our adjunct faculty as well.
You have had, you know, a lot of experience supporting students, and you mentioned that the students graduating in 2020 have a bit of a different outlook. And of course, those that were part of OT education programs during this time will just have a very different experience of their OT education than you or I did as students.
Yeah.
What do you hope that students will recognize as valuable as part of their experience of learning during the pandemic? And again, I know it's been tough. I think we can't understate that it's been a hard year for a lot of people for a lot of reasons, but what might they take away as valuable?
You know, I hope that they take away a feeling that they really can do anything. You know, that feeling that they are capable. You know, we always talk about a commitment to lifelong learning. And I think sometimes that seems philosophical, like, yeah, people who go into OT need to agree to always do continuing ed. But I hope that they really see the value in that and saw that even experienced practitioners in the year 2020 were having to take a step back and get into the literature and network and read and learn what to do because this was so unexpected. So I hope that that commitment to lifelong learning has moved from kind of a philosophical agreement to a real commitment and a recognition of how important it is to always be learning throughout our entire careers, no matter where that takes us. So confidence and commitment to lifelong learning are things that really stand out to me in relationship to what I hope a student takes out of it. And something that I have seen is grace for faculty too. I've had years where course evaluations are hurtful, right? That you've done so well and your best, and there might only be one or two out of 50 that say something hurtful, but it is really hurtful sometimes to get feedback from maybe a student whose maybe expectations weren't appropriate or didn't really understand the work that goes into that. And I think this year we're having a lot more, thank you. We recognize how hard this is. Thank you for making sure that this was still a great class for us. Thank you for making sure that we could keep moving forward in school. We're hearing a lot more gratitude, and it feels so good, and it helps you commit to, this is why I'm up at 10 o'clock at night still grading. This is why I'm taking a phone call on a Saturday or a Sunday. It's easier to do those things, and it feels better to do those things when you really know that it's making a difference. And it probably always has been, but I think we're hearing from students this year more gratitude, and it has philosophically helped me during those hard times to know that the work we've put into these alternate plans or these alternate expectations has been recognized by the student body. So I do hope that faculty give each other grace, that program directors give their faculty grace, that students give each other grace. I just think if I could think of one word for 2020, that's really it. Just this level of recognition that we're all always doing our best, and just this trust and faith in each other, I think is really important and something that I hope people remember when they think about 2020.
Absolutely. I think it's, at least in my experience, it's caused us to see each other's humanity in a bit of a different way. Teaching from my guest room where you can see the bed behind me.
Yeah.
You get a glimpse into the lives of your faculty and your students in a really different way. And I think that was a bit awkward at first, right? Just to kind of open our lives in this virtual environment. But I think it has been a really interesting way to allow one another to kind of have a shared experience. So
I agree. Yeah, I'm in my younger son's room now. You know, you're in your guest room. Absolutely. We've seen that with our students. And I think it helps faculty to remember that their students are human. And, you know, as occupational therapists, we know that these are just roles that we play, and that being a student is not the only role that they play. And sometimes I think we forget when we think, why didn't they come to this? Or they listened to that lecture on 1.5 speed, or they didn't do that optional assignment, because this is part of who they are. This is not all of who they are. And it's okay with me if they make a decision to be with their child and to lose 10 points on a discussion board. I'm okay with that. And I think more people are becoming okay with that, because we are really recognizing that this is part of who they are. And us being faculty, us being educators, is also part of who we are. And I always say, you know, nobody's going to stand up at anybody's funeral and say, you know, she always answered her emails within 24 hours, just like her syllabus said. And that's going to be on my headstone that she got her grading done in 5 days all the time, 100% of the time. That's not what they're going to say. They're going to say that you're a good friend and a good spouse and a good parent and all of that. And I think faculty will remember that and think about that in relationship to their students, maybe more than we have in the past. This is part of who they are. And we hope that we create educational environments that are valuable enough and engaging enough and supportive enough that they want to be everywhere and do all of the pieces of it and engage with all of it. But they may choose not to once in a while. And it's not personal. It has to do with the fact that life is complicated, and it's more complicated in 2020 and likely still in 2021 than it has been in a long time. Absolutely. At least in my life. I know, Lauren, we may have people listening to us that are thinking, oh gosh, you know, about some issue in the past or other time in the past, but really for the current college generation, you know, this is it. This is the first time. This is the thing that is likely going to define their lives.
As we wrap up, and what a great conversation it's been, and thank you so much for sharing with us, I'm curious what your final thoughts are related to next steps. If we could break it down just to have different categories of next steps for our different groups of listeners, let's start with what your practical takeaways are for students.
So for students, you know, occupational balance is more important now than it has ever been. So I would recommend critically analyzing all of the roles that you play in your life and reflecting on how important each of them are to you, and then working to ensure that you can be present and contributory in all of those roles. So, you know, I say things like get a planner and use a planner, but really right now you have got to figure out a way to carve out time for your studies and for your school and for the amount of time it's going to take you to be successful and all of the other things that are important to you too. Carve out time for that stuff too. Identify times that you're not going to do school, because when you're home and it's all online, that line between when you should stop studying and when you should keep going is harder. It's not like you get to just drive home from school and you get a little bit of a break. It is harder. So if you can really think through all of the roles that you play that are important to you and ensure that you've given them all your time and your energy, that's going to contribute to your overall mental health and your overall success. So I really think that that's important, and also finding a support system. So if you're new to college, like this is your first semester in OT school, maybe you haven't had an opportunity to make as many connections or to connect with your instructors the way that maybe your upperclassmen have. And I would really encourage you to do that. Reach out to your instructors. Schedule a Zoom or a WebEx or whatever it is that you use for no reason other than to say hi and get to know each other. There may be barriers to that relationship building, but you are smart and you are capable, and you can find ways to ensure that you are developing and building those relationships. Because whenever we are back on campus full time, those relationships will be really important for you. So I think that's really important for students. And then also just to have that open mind, know that, you know, we're in a day-to-day situation with directed health measures and COVID and outcomes and how this has impacted our college environments. And, you know, I always say we could find out tomorrow that we can't do the thing that's scheduled for next Tuesday. But the only thing I can promise you is that you're not going to leave my class without demonstrating competency in the identified learning objectives. But it may look different, and I don't want that for you. I don't want it to look different. I recognize that that's harder, but just be open to those new things or those alternative things as much as you can be, recognizing that there's so much that's out of the control of your specific program that you're enrolled in.
What about practical takeaways for faculty members or program leaders or directors?
You know, I definitely feel as a program director this pull where I may be working at 10 o'clock at night, but I never want my team to think that they have to. So I've received a lot of advice from my mentors that I would love to pass along. And one thing is delay the delivery of your emails. So if you're working at night or on the weekends, but you don't want your team to interpret that that means you think they should be, most email systems have a delay delivery component where you can ensure that they get that email during whatever standard work hours. Because you may perceive that, oh, just because I emailed you 7 times on Saturday doesn't mean I think you should be working on Saturday, but they do perceive that. They do think that. So delay delivery of email has been just a really important thing for me, where I don't feel guilty reaching out and asking for something. I don't feel guilty if that's the way that my life worked that week, but I can ensure that that person receives it in more of an appropriate time. And then learn from your team as well. When are they working? What are they doing at home? Do they have children on remote learning? Do they have another peer or a spouse that is also on a remote job? And how is that going to impact your team meetings or how people engage in meetings? And for example, you know, my son's on remote learning until 2 o'clock. So I would prefer to meet after 2 o'clock because then I know I'm not going to need to help him. And what's going on with your team and how can you be respectful of that with your team as well? I encourage people too to set their calendars to show their availability, to block out the things that are meaningful to them. And it can show as private, right? If you want to spend 6 hours doing an art project with your kiddo because you're upset that remote learning doesn't include art, do it. That's important to you. Block that time out. You don't even have to tell me what it's for. As long as you get your job done in a timely manner, according to the expectations of our institution, you know, there needs to be a lot of flexibility in that. So I really encourage program directors to communicate clearly what that ultimate goal is. And for me, it's what are your policies in your syllabus? What did you say you were going to do? And ensure that you can do that. Like if you said you're available, be available. If you said you're going to get stuff to them in 10 days, get it to them in 10 days. However, there's so much flexibility in what that might look like. And I would encourage program directors to make sure that their teams know what's important to you as a leader and what you're willing to let them have control of as well. And eliminate things that aren't necessary. That's something my college has recently done that has been such a huge help. Even to the point where I told my husband, I said, man, I'm not sure how much of this I'm going to put back on my plate because this feels for the first time like a job that I can get done in 40 hours a week. And it's never felt like that. It's always felt like a 50 plus hour job. But this year, it feels like a 40 hour job. Now, there may still be nights and weekends because there's more conflicts during the day. But there's not nights and weekends plus 8 to 5 Monday through Friday like there used to be. And I think it has a lot to do with we tend in academia to create a committee or a task force for every little problem. And we've dropped all of those initiatives, right? Like it's been student success is the only thing that matters right now, right? Like do a good job instructing your students, be there for them, ensure that they're successful. And we can redo the syllabi template next year. We can, you know, alter this policy or have this big focus group about this other thing down the road. So I would encourage people to really think through which initiatives they currently have going on that are still essential, or like you said earlier, maybe those can fall to the bottom for right now and we can revisit and pick up things maybe next summer. I'm being really hopeful, but I'm thinking maybe next summer we would feel ready to pick those things up again. I personally feel like that has really helped myself as a leader, and it's really helped my team too. We've decreased the amount of time our faculty meet. We've ensured that we stick to, you know, if we have an hour, we really try to end those meetings right at an hour. That's been hard. That really has been hard because people have more to say and more to talk about when we're not seeing each other, but just really trying to be respectful of people's time, you know, allowing kids to be on laps if necessary, allowing people to fold laundry in the background if necessary, just really understanding how complex life is right now. So I think both faculty and program directors just need to be transparent and clear in their communication, you know, work on setting those boundaries and ensure that they can fulfill their roles, just like that advice that I had for the student. So if you were going to go talk to your team, that would be what I would recommend that you ask. I would say, what does your typical day look like now in the pandemic? And if I contacted you, when would you prefer I contact you? And if we met, when would you prefer that we met? And here's the list of things our department's working on. Which two do we as a team think are most important? And when should we readdress the others? Just really identify priorities and allow people to utilize their time to focus on the students until we really get through this.
That makes me think of Brené Brown has a quote that I just really love, and it's clear is kind and unclear yes. is unkind. And I just think besides really having to focus on what matters, that clear communication for faculty, staff, students is so important and is really the way that we support each other best.
Oh, for sure.
Environment and beyond.
You bet. I've received feedback before in my life that has always been surprising to me, but it really had to do with clarity. So my messaging was always, I'm approachable and you can come to me at any time, but I like to work with my door shut. And I was doing things that were contrary to what I was saying. My messaging and my delivery were not congruent, were not consistent, and it was creating an unclear situation. And even in this pandemic, like I mentioned earlier, you know, everybody has my cell phone for the first time in forever, but it took a lot of times for me to say, I am serious. You are allowed to contact me. However, not after 8 p.m. and whenever, whatever you think your rules are, right? And yeah, you're right. Clear is kind. And I just adore Brené Brown and her work on vulnerability, and think that if you listener are not familiar with her or have not gotten into her work, this is absolutely the time to do it.
Last takeaway, you know, there may be some listeners that are practitioners, they're removed from higher education these days, but are in the clinical setting. What are the takeaways for them and how can they support students through this time and beyond as well?
Yeah, we always think about fieldwork because we're not doing a good job as an academic institution if we're not preparing students who can be successful when they get into the clinical environment. But I just want to make sure fieldwork educators know that these students have had a different face-to-face experience, and they may have missed out on a couple things that we just couldn't find an alternative strategy or solution for. And it's not that they aren't prepared, but they may be a little bit more uncomfortable. They may have, you know, learned that hemiparetic dressing skill in an online environment. It doesn't mean they don't know it, but I would have a lot of grace for them too. I would allow them to, you know, just recognize that the student of 2020 may have not had as much face-to-face touch points with their instructor as the student before. And we still don't know, you know, long term, how that's going to translate into how they perform on level two fieldwork. You know, next year will be the first year for most programs where students go out who were educated in a partially online environment, potentially for the first time in 2020. So we will have to watch long term. But until then, I really hope fieldwork educators and clinicians that take students really want to work with the academic institution, feel like we are your partners, reach out to us and ask us questions about, you know, what should this student know? And I'm seeing this deficit, and what would you recommend? Like, we are here to collaborate with you, and we want that feedback. We look for patterns in that feedback, and it helps us make decisions. But if we don't get that feedback until the end, it's hard for us to help you support the student. So just recognize that the world was a little different for them. And we are going to find out, I think, in the next year, how that translates into their performance right away. Now, we do know students are incredibly resilient and they learn very quickly. I would anticipate that they would very quickly get on their feet. But those first couple weeks, you may see a slower onboarding time with a student who's just a little bit more nervous because they are unsure if they are really ready, right? School has looked different for them. And then also, you know, remember too that COVID is new and is not something that is a standard part of curriculum. And just like clinicians are having to learn how to work with a patient who looks, you know, COVID patients look incredibly different. I think you have a podcast with someone who talked about how different these patients can look. Recognize too that you as a practitioner may be working with someone and you have a fieldwork student with you, and recognize when they shouldn't know what to do, when you're going to be teaching them, because there really is no way for us to operationalize doing a good job educating someone on how to treat a condition that has just came out of nowhere and we don't have a ton of evidence on best practices yet. So we're gonna look to you as a clinician to help us with what that looks like and to take a little bit of responsibility for, you know, educating that student on how to work with that COVID patient or post-COVID or whatnot. Some of these diagnoses were not in curriculums because they didn't exist. And we're going to really rely on that fieldwork educator to be more of a partner with us and ensuring that that student has that skill set to work safely with those patients.
Well, great. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, some of your learnings. Of course, I do want to mention that what Melissa shared are her own, you know, opinions and her own experience of the educational journey through this year and are not a reflection of her institution. So thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and best wishes as you round out 2020 and look to 2021. We'll all be waiting to see what next week brings.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Thanks.
Wow, you guys, this podcast really helped me give language to the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead in 2021 for OT education and just for OT at large. This is the kind of episode that really reminded me how well-poised occupational therapy practitioners are to be leaders in navigating change. So I hope wherever you find yourself, you feel empowered to tackle whatever challenges lie ahead this year with grace. If you are interested in earning a continuing education certificate for your time today, what you are going to do next is head to otpotential.com and you can either sign in or sign up for the OT Potential Club. The OT Potential Club is our OT evidence-based practice platform. And once you are there, you are going to want to click on the button that says CEU Courses. And from there, you'll be prompted to take a 5-question test. And if you earn 75% or higher, you will have a certificate sent to your inbox. On that same course page, you will also find some handouts created by Melissa Kimmerling, one for clinicians, one for students, and one for educators, all with reflective questions to help you just continue to unpack some of what we discussed here. We also have a discussion forum where if any thoughts or questions were sparked for you today, we would love to hear them in that forum. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us today. I hope this podcast helps you broaden your knowledge, tweak your practice, and stay evidence-based. Take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next month.